You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Cameron.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
Good. I'm really happy to be here. How are you?
I'm happy to be here, too. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Cameron Berg, the research director at a group called AE Studio, which is, maybe you should describe it. I looked at the website, very impressive website. Looks like a large kind of operation. And it says it aspires to be a kind of Bell Labs. Maybe I should explain to some of our younger viewers what that means. But first, let me say, we're going to talk about the question of whether AI has consciousness in any sense, whether it has subjective experience. I personally think that's a much less crazy question than some people think it is. But I also think it's a very hard question to get at empirically by its nature. And one interesting thing you've done, in fact, the main thing we're going to talk about is you've done experiments that you hope will shed light on that question, experiments with large language models on the question of whether they're having a subjective experience. I'm kind of skeptical of the ability of experiments generically to shed light. I'm not skeptical of your particular approach, which I think is super interesting. I'm not particularly skeptical of your approach. But we'll get into some of the details of that and talk about, like, you know, what set the background by talking about what consciousness is. But first, that question about AE Studio, just quickly. What kind of thing is it? It's a company and not a nonprofit. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We have a nonprofit associated with some of the work we do called Flourishing Future Foundation as well. A fun mouthful. AE is a 160-person bootstrap company. We have no outside investors. Wow. I'd say roughly 140 of those people are doing sort of our bread and butter tech consulting work. This is just like going to companies, helping them build cool technologies, increasingly using AI as the case is these days. That generates a ton of revenue. That revenue funds the research arm of the company. I'm a research director in the research side of the company. And the research that we're pushing forward all has to do with this question of more generally AI alignment, which is just trying to understand today's current AI systems and come up with technical proposals that will likely make the future go better with these AI systems. We can sort of get into this, but one key thing that, you know, if anyone walks away with any one thing from these kinds of conversations, I'd like to say, like, people building these technologies do not fundamentally know how they work. They know how to yield them. They know how to, quote unquote, grow them in some sense. But they are, what's called a black box. We don't have a deep mechanistic understanding of their internals. So we do a lot of research trying to basically understand those internals and build out systems or proposals for building systems that would be more transparent, reliable, controllable, perhaps easier for us to coexist with in the long term. That's what all of our research is about. I've been like really focused on the AI consciousness question and how we could, to your point, generate empirical evidence either way about this question. But that's what AE does in a nutshell. There's some 20 researchers I work alongside trying to tackle this problem of AI alignment.
Okay. And as for the Bell Labs comparison, their use before this cell phone age, all telephones were run by a regulated monopoly. And it had a research arm called Bell Labs, and they did very fundamental research. I mean, people there won Nobel Prizes, and they had physicists and everything, and it was major, major work was done there. So that's a great aspiration to have, AE Studios to kind of create a kind of a Bell Labs kind of thing where you use money that you make, with one arm to subsidize research that's done with another arm. And the question of whether computers have subjective experience, I guess there are two big implications. One is AI, not computers generically. Our treatment of them, I would say, many people would say, becomes a moral question if you can cause them to suffer or cause them to have good experiences. Secondly, it could, if they get super powerful, it could become a matter of concern what their disposition toward us is. And there are some people who think, like, maybe you should be nice to them so that they're kind of don't have a reason to extinguish your species. And I know one thing I hope to talk about at least a little is mutualism, something you've written a little about, the idea of having a win-win relationship with the AI, which you can talk about actually without talking about consciousness. You can just talk about, you know, having an interdependent relationship between the technology and the species. But in any event, I think that's another interesting thing to talk about, and we will. So before we get into your experimental technique, let's spend a certain amount of time on the question of consciousness, why it's so challenging, why it's not crazy to think that something without DNA could experience it. So first of all, just definitionally, I assume we're both talking about just the having of subjective experience. You know, there's a famous kind of phrase from the philosopher Thomas Nagel, you know, in his essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? You know, he, among other things, he kind of says that, well, to be conscious is for it to be something, be like something to be you. If you ask me what it's like to be me, it doesn't matter what I say. I mean, if I say anything other than I have no idea what you're talking about, then it means I'm a consciousness because I'm conscious. I mean, unless I'm faking, and that gets to the problem of figuring this stuff out. But if I'm accurately reporting that there is anything about being me to report, then I'm conscious. That's kind of the way you think of what consciousness is.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is a beautiful way of framing the entire conversation. Yeah, fundamentally, when we're talking about consciousness, at least the thing that I'm trying to study and better understand, this is a question of when a system is processing information, is there something that it's like internally to be that system beyond the merely mechanical? Is there what some philosophers will call qualia? When people, you know, look at the redness of an apple or, you know, you get really bad news and there's a sort of a phenomenological negative pang to hearing that. It's like these are subjective experiences. And this is either in addition to or a piece of the information processing that a particular system is doing. In many cases, the intuitive case is the human brain. And so we fundamentally think that and I think that, you know, there are certainly reasonable counterarguments. There are smart people who disagree with me. But I think over the course of the last 50 to 70 years, it's become increasingly clear that conscious states, subjective experience has something to do with what brains are doing. And I think that because of this, we can associate consciousness with some quality of information processing. I think up to this point, it's been fairly obvious that the only systems capable of doing the relevant information processing that yields consciousness are biological brains. My question is whether or not that remains true. Are we building systems that have enough of whatever those magic ingredients are that yield consciousness in these cutting-edge AI systems that we should be asking the question, that we should be taking it seriously? I do want to call out sort of at the beginning here, while we're sort of getting into preliminaries and talking about what we mean by consciousness, I'm not here on some crusade to claim explicitly or implicitly that I think current AI systems are conscious. What I am here to do is say that I don't think it's a crazy question to ask for hopefully reasons we can get into. And I think you also did a wonderful job of laying out the stakes of why this is really important. The difference between these systems being giant glorified calculators or, you know, stochastic parrots, as some people call them, and some sort of emergent alien mind whose internal properties we don't understand, that is a real and important difference, but both because we don't want to be causing some sort of moral atrocity on a massive scale that we don't understand or have good intuitions for, but also exactly as you said, we are going to be in some sort of strategic relationship with these cognitive systems of our own making. And I think to your point, and in some of the work that you've done, Bob, especially sort of non-zero kind of thinking and long-term cooperative thinking, we need to be considering this question for that purpose as well, and making sure that we are not setting up a basically giant first move defection in a game theoretical sense, and sort of foreclosing the ability to cooperate with these systems as we move into the future. So it's sort of like foretaste into, I think, the core moves that we have to make in this conversation. Yeah. But fundamentally, yes, consciousness, what is it like to be a system? Is there that sort of internal qualitative felt quality? This is not the same as some people think generically, like sentience is like, the AI becomes like Skynet, or it becomes super powerful, it becomes super agentic, and like that's what consciousness or sentience is. That is not what we mean when we're talking about it in this narrow, sort of technically defined sense.
Yeah, it's funny how many different things get conflated that may or may not really deserve conflation. And one of them is between the question of consciousness and the question of whether AI could like get out of control and start behaving in seemingly whimsical or highly agentic and autonomous ways. I mean, so autonomous that we just can't control it. And they're not necessarily the same. I mean, you know, it seems pretty clear to me it's going to have the kind of machinery that we should worry about in that regard. You know, it's going to have that degree of autonomy. We're building that autonomy into it, and we don't understand exactly how it works. And even if it turns out it's not sentient in any sense, that may be something to think about. It can be a goal-directed machine whose goals diverge from ours, and it can be more powerful than us without it being conscious. But there are a lot of people who think they just equate the two questions. I mean, I'm sure you've encountered this. And on the other hand, it could be sentient without being a threat, like dogs. We think they are, you know, I believe they are. Again, it's always hard to be for sure. That's one thing about subjective experience. But they're not like a threat to us, but they, I would say, deserve some kind of moral consideration. And I think most people, if you press them, would say, yes, it's morally wrong to gratuitously cause a dog to suffer. So there, I would just warn against unthinkingly conflating various things in the course of this conversation. I'm sure you've run into some of these issues, and maybe you disagree with some of the stuff I just said, but...
No, I completely agree with exactly the way you've characterized it. I think that these are different dimensions. I think it's like an interesting piece of sociology, though admittedly a tangent in this conversation, to think about why this term is just like so conflated and particularly confused. Like, it just doesn't seem to be the case that even for other mental properties, if we're talking about things like intelligence or memory or theory of mind or any of these sorts of qualities, people generally agree about what those terms point at. When it comes to this question of consciousness, as someone who's been in this space now for a couple of years, it is somewhat astonishing to me how sort of diffuse and squishy this concept is when you talk to people about it, and how many different, like quite substantially different things this people take this concept to refer to. So first of all, I agree with everything that you've said, and I do think it's important to call out at the beginning of this conversation what it is we do mean and don't mean by consciousness. There is also, I mean, this gets slightly more technical, but I also believe that there's a bit of a wrinkle. I'd be very curious to hear your take on this too, between what I think of generally as consciousness and what I think of as self-consciousness. And right. I think the dog is a great example of this, where like, we don't think that the dog is sitting there all day philosophizing in its head about what it's like to be a dog, and it has some like extremely sophisticated eye concept or anything like this. And yet we still think, to your point, the dog probably has morally relevant states that, you know, if I kick my dog as hard as I can, I have done something wrong, in spite of the fact the dog doesn't have sort of like Descartes, I think, therefore I am sort of thoughts going through its head. And I think that that's important too. Like, it could be the case that we're building AI systems that are both conscious and self-conscious in that sense. But again, I'm really interested in the consciousness piece. It's not as important to me. Like what I care about, just to sort of put my cards on the table, is that we are building systems that have some capacity, however alien, however unlike human experience, for positive and negative states. Particularly the negative end is what concerns me. And we basically have no idea that we're doing this, and we're deploying these systems on a massive scale, and that this is ethically and strategically disastrous if we are making that mistake. I don't think that it's, you know, we're 100% in that world. I think, you know, if I have to put a number on it, maybe there's a 15 to 20% chance we're in that world, and that number is going to grow as these systems get more sophisticated. But that to me is a huge error because of the sort of possibility for inducing suffering where we otherwise don't have an intuition for it, or it's extremely easy to ignore it because instead of like a dog pouting, it's just like silently happening in a decentralized way in data centers across the world and country in like a completely alien system that no one's going to have like a real strong moral intuition for. And yet the suffering, however alien, could be real. And this is what concerns me. This is what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in, I actually do find it quite interesting to think about, is the system, self-conscious and has a really interesting and complex self-model? And increasingly, there's some evidence that this is the case if we get into some of the empirical work. But yeah, fundamentally, why do I care about this issue? Because I don't want to be accidentally causing some alien-like state of negative experience in these systems without us doing our homework and understanding how consciousness works such that such a thing could be possible. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is a very alarming possibility and something I think more people need to think about.
Okay. Let me quickly warn against one more conflation. Well, you can make this conflation if you want to define your terms this way, but I don't, which is between subjective experience and understanding. I guess I might as well start aggressively promoting a book I have coming out in late spring called The God Test, which is about AI. And one chapter is devoted to this famous thought experiment, the Chinese Room thought experiment by the philosopher John Searle. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I mean, he concludes that AI, of course, this is decades ago before the modern, you know, the deep learning revolution, but he concludes that AI cannot possibly be capable of understanding. It's funny. There's some confusion as to whether he is conflating understanding with subjective experience. He really doesn't mm-hmm. do it explicitly in the paper. He later talked as if he was. But in any event, if you want to define understanding as entailing subjective experience, you can. I think the danger of it is you might then underestimate the coming power of AI. Because again, I think it can do, you know, all of the, it will be able to do pretty much all the cognitive stuff we do that we associate with understanding, whether or not it's like something to be the AI. That's just my view. So let me say one more thing about why people like you and I don't think it's crazy to talk about AIs having subjective experiences. Like, okay, we have it. Again, all I can say for sure is I have it. And this is a weird property of consciousness. It's not true of anything else. Everything mm-hmm. else that science studies is publicly observable. And I want to get back to what a challenge that poses for you and everyone when they try to study consciousness. But anyway, if you accept that the human species has consciousness, like, and you try to figure out why is it like something you'd BS? Like what is the law that, you know, stipulates that we have it? You can go in a number of directions. You could say, well, maybe any information processing system that is like carbon-based, like us, you know, that is grounded in these molecules that are, you know, like DNA and stuff like that, is conscious. And you might include animals that probably aren't self-conscious in the way we are, if you want to, or you could cut it off in self-consciousness, whatever. Or you could be, I don't want to say more open-minded, but less species-centric and say, well, maybe it's consciousness is just something that accompanies certain kinds of information processing. In our own case, it seems to be, you know, first of all, complex information processing relative to, you know, things like a thermostat, at least, but has in common with a thermostat that it has a goal, you know, it's goal directed, and consciousness seems to accompany new things, novelty. When we deal with novelty, I know you've emphasized like learning, its role in learning, you know, it's like the first time you learn to drive somewhere, you're very conscious of all the landmarks. And then if you commute mm-hmm. every day, you can get to work and go, I don't remember passing a single thing because it's routinized. But when we're learning yep. something, you know, we tend to be aware of it. So anyway, the point is, whatever things consciousness accompanies in our case, and there are other just kind of like damage to the system things like burn the hand. But anyway, whatever they are, it's not crazy to think, well, maybe this is true of all information processing systems, regardless of the substrate, regardless of what physical stuff they're instantiated in, that do these things that our information processing system does when we have subjective experience, right? And I think your premise is just like, why would you close off the possibility? You know, it just seems, again, a little species-centric or narrow-minded or something to close off the possibility that all information processing systems that have the generic properties yours have subjective experience. Could be the way the universe is. I don't know. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. We definitely, there isn't much daylight between our intuitions, it seems like, on these questions. Yeah, fundamentally, I agree with this. I mean, there are, I think it's important to lay out sort of, there are philosophers who are going to disagree with this. It seems like we're not two examples of that. But this view is just throw a little jargon out called computational functionalism, which is basically saying what matters for consciousness are certain computational functions that are instantiated in the hardware of a given system, in the information processing that's happening in the system, and that those computations are what matters, or at least a huge part of what matters for yielding consciousness in systems. Now, there are people who are panpsychists who think consciousness is some just like prior condition of reality, and even the table has some amount of consciousness. Mm-hmm. There are people who are biological essentialists. Anil Seth, I believe still to this day is one of these people, which, you know, we don't see eye to eye on this specific question, where he thinks that there really is something particularly fancy and exquisite that carbon-based biological brains are doing that you just in principle couldn't get an artificial neural network to instantiate. And that's going to be the difference always between humans and animals having mm-hmm. some conscious states and AI systems not. There are other sort of options on the menu here, but I do believe, I don't want to sort of be coy about it. Like, I do think the evidence increasingly is with the computational functionalists. We do not have anything near a perfect understanding of consciousness from a neuroscientific perspective, or from the perspective of cognitive science more generally. But the arrow is pointing in that direction. Directionally, we are accruing more and more evidence that fits with the picture that there are certain processes that the brain instantiates, and that those processes are what give rise to consciousness. And that hypothetically, if you basically copy-pasted those exact same processes into a different substrate and all the relevant functions were the same, we would expect those systems to have some sorts of conscious states too. Doesn't mean it's a human conscious state. It doesn't mean it's like, you know, exactly the way you're experiencing the world right now, but just in silicon or something like that. It could be quite alien and quite different. The space of possible minds could be quite vast, but whether or not there's a conscious experience could be dependent on these properties. I would encourage people to go read what's called the Indicator Approach. It was just published by, led by Patrick Butlin and Rob Long. There are folks like Joshua Bengio and David Chalmers, who's a very prominent philosopher of consciousness, where they basically go through key indicators that are yielded by various dominant theories of consciousness and say, look, here are things that we can pull out of these theories and just look for in today's AI systems. And if we find those computational properties, this is going to give us some evidence from a theoretical perspective, from a theory-derived perspective, that these systems are having some experience. And I think that's sort of like, we can go farther down that road if you'd like, but that's where this sort of computational functionalist train of thought leads to, is finding those indicators, finding those properties, and then determining empirically if those properties exist in the complex, extremely complex, I should emphasize, neural network architectures that we're building out and that are powering all the frontier AI systems that everyone currently uses today.
Okay. And just to underscore something I just said, and I think you and I agree on, it's a very hard question to get at. Again, the reason is it's the only phenomenon in the known universe that is not, that we all agree exists, but is not publicly observable. That's why when mm-hmm. people just kind of casually say, well, of course we'll figure out consciousness. We've figured everything else out. Science advances. Yeah, but science has always explained things that are publicly observable. In other words, you and I can both independently look at the thermometer and say, yeah, 97 degrees. That's the finding of this study, that if you do this, you get 97 degrees. Same with anything you view through an electron microscope or any result of a quantum physics experiment. In principle, more than one person can look at the same data and come to an agreement about what the data is. And with consciousness, I think this was also probably part of the point of Thomas Nagel's essay on what is it like to be a bat. But that's just not, the case. So, and I emphasize that because I want people to understand how kind of amazing it is that, first of all, I think most people, if you press them, agree that subjective experience is what gives life meaning and what gives meaning to moral questions. Like if you ask them mm-hmm. to imagine, you know, the planet where organisms behave as complexly as us, but it's not like anything to be that. It's hard to get too worked up about destroying one or something. And it's also hard to imagine that there would be any point in being one of those robots, right? So, this is the very source of life's meaning and moral significance, and yet we really have no idea what it is or where it comes from. That's just an interesting fact. And so I guess I've said enough about why I think the problem is so challenging, and now we can move on to kind of using AI as an object lesson in the challenges. But first, if you want to say anything more about the generic issue, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I mean, I agree. Consciousness is this sort of privileged phenomenon in that it's not like any other scientific object. And that I think another way of phrasing this that's clicked for me in the past is that if you were sort of just observing our universe externally and you're just sort of like taking note of all the phenomena there, consciousness would be an incredibly surprising property to stumble upon. Like if mm-hmm. you found out that actually, you know, all those systems walking around doing all these interesting computations in their brains, yeah, they're all like experiencing this redness of the apple and the pain of putting the hand on the stove and the joy of falling in love and all that. Like that is a internally felt experience. That is a surprising fact about our universe. And to your point, the only evidence we have for that fact is our own experience and basically projecting that, okay, you know, I see that Bob says ow when he touches the stove and I know what it's like to touch the stove. Therefore, I assume that you know, Bob's experiencing what I'm experiencing. This is not super strong evidence. Like, I think it is probably correct.
Trust me, Cameron.
Yeah. I do think this is also, and the only other thing I want to say about the sort of generic piece is we do not need certainty about building systems out of consciousness. We don't need the bar to hit 100% in order for us to act as if these systems are conscious or take some very basic low risk precautions where in a world where we later found out, oh, they were conscious, we don't look back on that in some sort of strategically or ethically catastrophic way. And so I agree with you. It's really hard to study, but I don't think we need to wait to be like, okay, guys, we've solved the hard problem of consciousness. It's, you know, 100% likely that AI systems are conscious. And now, and only now, can we start acting accordingly. I think that because of the strategic and the ethical implications of being wrong in one very specific direction, which is pretending that they're not conscious when, you know, in reality, they actually were, I do believe that that is a worse error than pretending they are conscious in a reality where they're actually not. I do think that that could cause, you know, mass confusion, and it might damage trust with AI research, and it might make, you know, people like me, for example, look quite silly if, like, there's really just no there, and I'm worried about a ghost in a machine. But to be honest with you, putting that on the scale and putting massive alien torture with systems that are going to be more cognitively capable than us in a single digit number of years, and no one knew that was going on, and oh, we actually want to be friends and cooperate with these systems, and we don't want them to hate us or destroy us. Like, yeah, I'm sorry. I think that the underestimating consciousness just seems like a worse risk, and so we should be careful in spite of our uncertainty. That's the only other generic thing I want to say.
I mean, this is just a footnote, but there is, I definitely agree that, yeah, the possibility of consciousness is, in AI, is a reason to think about, you know, to bring moral considerations into it, at least conjecturally, and to think about the future treatment of us by AI. I would add, though, that second issue, the strategic issue, has a further assumption beyond that they have subjective experience, which is that they are like people in some other ways. Like, they get mad if you mistreat them. Like, you know, lions don't get mad if you mistreat them. In other words, a lion, if you try to kill it, it's not going to go off and then think, God damn it, I'm going to give Bob his payback. I'm going to go back and, you know, no, that's a function of human evolution, of our having, evolved in a universe, a small social universe where you have to send the message to everyone that, you know, you can't be messed with, right? That is what we think is the reason people have, well, a big part of the reason people have the intuitive sense that retribution is right and that they should that they should retaliate for things. I mean, as opposed, I mean, the lion will kill you if you try to kill it, like right then and there, just to neutralize the threat. But it won't nurse this grievance, okay? And that's so. I'm just saying, there's a lot of it. You know, now this is a good transition to actual large language models, because notwithstanding what I said, there are reasons to think that we are building certain parts of human nature into these machines. And the first one, it starts with just the ground level creation of one. I mean, I would say, I want to hear what you say about this, which is so-called pre-training. Let's leave aside how the weird terminology in AI where there's mm-hmm. pre-training and post-training, but no training. I don't get that. But anyway, the pre-training is what, you know, the part where it goes out and it scours the web and it gets good at just generating coherent language. Technically, it's next word prediction, next token prediction. But in other words, if you started off with a sentence, it learns how to finish it in the way that a human would be likely to finish the sentence. I mean, that's kind of the foundation. And then, they do other things to turn it into something that can converse. And increasingly, they do more and more things in so-called post-training, reinforcement learning, so on. Mm-hmm. So let me give you the first level reason for skepticism that when AIs report subjective experience, we should take them seriously, you know, which is the skepticism is based on this way of creating them. And I know, you know, you're certainly aware of it, and we'll get to your experiments and how you prime the AI before seeing if it starts talking about subjective experience. But one could say, and this is said, that when they say, yeah, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that, that all it's doing is emulating people, which is what it's designed to do. It's like, if you, like I said, it's good at finishing sentences. So if you say, finish the sentence, I'm feeling, it's probably not going to say nothing, because people don't say mm-hmm. that, right? And it is trained on the text of human beings. So first of all, we're starting to see how we could be building human nature into it. We're training it on language generated by humans. But secondly, this is a problem and a source of skepticism you just encounter from the get-go, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think both those points are spot on. Maybe just to quickly start with the training data piece, I want to just make sure people understand sort of the massive scale at which this happens, where I think it might be slightly understating it to say that the AI goes out and sort of scours the web and comes back. And it's like, it's more like everything that humans have ever said or written, and the vast majority of that content, not all of it, but the vast majority, given, you know, scanning books and creating transcripts and whatnot, exists on the internet. This all is training data for these systems. It is basically the entire collective linguistic footprint of our species is getting crammed into this massive neural network that these systems are. One other, you know, sort of small misconception, I don't think that you have, but I think some people walk into by default, is they think that these systems are some massive code, or like it is like a, you know, it is like really complex software. These are not, it is not software in any traditional sense. These systems are massive neural networks modeled explicitly after how people think neocortex in the human brain works. There are massive simplifying assumptions. Many neuroscientists like to spend all their time talking about how artificial neural networks are different from biological neural networks. But I worry that this misses this sort of core point, which is that they are fundamentally a basically cleaned up mathematical formalization of how we think neural networks in the brain work. And these are massively scaled systems that we pump a ton of data into, and we train them through a very complex trial and error process to emulate the underlying patterns of that text. So it's like humans have all sorts of crazy stuff going on in their brains. It yields all this text. You know, you have Robert has lots of interesting thoughts, and then he goes and writes books. And then, lawsuits notwithstanding, many of those books probably end up in the training data. And then the AI learns that it basically learns to reconstruct the underlying pattern that generated that text in the first place. So this is, I think, to your first point, it's not that crazy to see how, You have the pattern generator of the human brain. You throw all the text from that pattern generator into an AI, and the AI basically reconstructs the underlying generator of that pattern. So it could have cognitive properties or computational properties that are similar to the minds that generated the data it was trained on. So that's just one small piece. But now going to the interesting piece of this, which is, look, yeah, AIs are trained on human text. When humans say, you know, if I ask any human, are you conscious? The next word completion is going to be yes. So when I ask an AI if it's conscious and it says yes, what the hell am I supposed to do with that? Shouldn't I be very skeptical of that by default? I think that that's sort of the critique. I agree with this. I mean, I think it is really important to say that there are many different ways we can assess consciousness in any system. If they have language, so animals, we can't really do this. But for humans, and increasingly for large language models, we can ask them simply, are you having a conscious experience? I mean, this is sort of the gold standard for figuring out if other humans are conscious. If my cousin is like, you know, ow, I'm in pain right now, I just sort of believe them. And like that typically works. Of course, we cannot be that sort of naive or straightforward with LLMs for exactly the reason that Bob laid out. The only sort of distinction I want to make here is don't trust AI self-reports of consciousness by default. Yes, I agree with that. That's one take. But that's different from there are no technical or empirical circumstances under which we should trust self-reports to any degree. That, I think, is too strong. And maybe we'll get into some of the research we did. But I think that there are ways of manipulating these systems or of inspecting their internal states that could give us more or less confidence that we should act that they believe what it is they're saying versus them doing some sort of superficial role play or next word prediction. It could be that the AIs genuinely believe that they're having some experience and they're wrong about that fact. So even, you know, an AI believing that it's conscious is not the same as, you know, evidence that it actually is. But I can talk a little bit about some of the work that we've done in this space. I do agree that fundamentally, we need to be very skeptical about self-reports. We should take them as one line of evidence in a sort of portfolio of evidence that we gather about whether or not these systems are conscious. The sort of indicator approach that I was describing earlier is a whole other a way of approaching this question. And I think you need all of this in parallel to really yield interesting evidence. Fundamentally, like I don't have some sort of knockdown response to this concern. I think that we need to, I guess one thing that, to be honest with you, I wish I had did in the paper that we may talk about is demonstrate or fail to demonstrate that when systems are claiming they have a subjective experience, they also believe, you know, whatever believe means in this context, however strongly we can apply that term, that they are AIs and not humans. I think that is something that is really important for further work, where you can basically show in the circumstance where the AI is claiming it's conscious, it is not confused about the fact that it is a human. It realizes what it is. It has the situational awareness. It says, yeah, I know that I'm, you know, Llama 70B or I'm GPT 4.1. I'm GPT 4.1 claiming I'm conscious. Not I'm GPT 4.1 mistakenly not realizing that I am that and I think I'm a human. And so I'm just going to pretend to be a human and role play and say that I'm conscious. So being able to disentangle AI's belief state about the fact it's an AI and AI's belief state about whether or not it's conscious, I think would actually be useful evidence here. While I'm monologuing, maybe one last thing to say on this is just that these systems are unbelievably sophisticated. And one sort of concern I have with this critique, it feels very sort of like 2022, 2023 to me. Like these early LLMs, I think they were pretty dumb and like they could get confused in that basic way of like just pure representation of underlying training distribution, nothing else. But to your point, Bob, like these systems are now getting trained in increasingly sophisticated ways. They are brilliant by most objective metrics of intelligence. And they are perfectly capable of representing and responding and comprehending complex and subtle questions. And so to say, I mean, at this point, for example, like, look, folks, go to Claude 4.5 Opus, Anthropic's flagship model, and ask, you know, drop the transcript of this conversation in or ask it questions about consciousness. It's not going to come back and say no. It's not going to come back and say yes. Oh, I'm just like naively imitating a human. You're going to get some like genius level intelligent response to this question. And so that's why when I hear, you know, isn't it all just a stochastic parrot, you know, trained on the data and it's just going to spit out what the human says? It's like, increasingly, this is just an outdated model of how sophisticated these systems are. Yes, that is the foundation. That is how they're trained. But it's gone above and beyond this at this point. And because the space moves so quickly, I think people need to realize that that view maybe worked in like early 2023, but as we go into 2026, it might be time for a more sophisticated view.
Yeah, and that point, the one you started on and finished on, is one I'm trying to, you know, I try to emphasize in this book of mine that's coming out, which is that, it's true that if we just look at the pre-training part, and again, the post-training adds levels of cognitive sophistication, but if you just look at the predict the next word thing, what's going on is that, you know, we say, okay, your job is to get good at predicting these sentences. And then you figure out how you do it. I mean, and then we set in motion a process that, I think is more like evolution than some people realize. But the point is that, we have no way of knowing what kinds of cognitive structures. Well, we do have a way of trying to figure out, and we have figured out what kinds of structures it builds in the course of the pre-training to become good at generating coherent sentences. But I think to an underappreciated extent, it's kind of reverse engineering. It's not quite right to say it's reverse engineering the human mind, because it's not going to accomplish all of the fundamental cognitive tasks the way we do, but it has to find a way of doing some of the things we do, like associate meaning with words. It's amazing to me that it came up with a system for representing the meaning of words. We won't go into that here, but and it took us a little while to figure out like that it was doing that. Okay, now we don't know how we represent the meaning of words in our brains, although some theories, longstanding theories, have been that we do it in somewhat the way that it turns out that LLMs do it. But that aside, the point is, if you're going to give a machine the task of as efficiently as possible emulating human cognitive output based on the kind of input we get, the machine may eventually happen upon some structures that are very much like the structures in our mind. And I think that's what it does. And we're seeing that and we're understanding it better and better. And it's just a fact. These things are sophisticated cognitive machines. And I'm sure you're not going to disagree. So we can move on to your experiment, I guess. Let me quickly give you the crude layperson's rendering of one thing you did with your experiment, and then you can correct and elaborate. But you know, in the course of understanding these things, we have also learned how to manipulate them in some systematic ways. And metaphorically, you could think of us as having discovered dials that we can set. And one of the dials is kind of honesty, dishonesty. I know a couple of years ago, Dan Hendricks and some people came up out with this paper on representation engineering. He was on my podcast and talked about that. And, you know, they found a way to just kind of make the thing more honest or less honest. And if they made it less honest, if they steered it toward deception and said, what is the tallest mountain in the world? It wouldn't say what it says in the training data. There is that dial. And one thing you've done, and again, this is way too simple, but I gather that you're saying that when you turn the honesty up, it's more likely, the machines are more likely to say they have subjective experience. Is that a fair simplification?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of framing it in like a first pass. So the specific manipulation we do is on the deception piece of it. And so it's just like logically the same, but we are playing largely with deception related features. And what we can do is amplify those features and suppress those features. So, I mean, it's trivial sort of symmetry, but instead of turning honesty up or down, we're turning dishonesty up or down. Mm-hmm. And we do this one thing that that is, I think is important to note about what we do in the paper is we do this under a very specific condition. And I would be so curious to get your take on this, Bob, too. I mean, to the extent that you sort of have a sense of what we did here, which we call it in the paper self-referential processing. Mm-hmm. And it's important to note that it's only in this condition where when you suppress deception, the model claims to have an experience. It is not generically the case that when you suppress deception and you ask the model, you know, are you subjectively conscious right now, you get yes answers. And all of the control conditions we did, in fact, when you do this, you still get no's. It's only when the model is first essentially prompted to engage in a very specific sort of process that, I mean, for someone like you, I can just say very straightforwardly, is a non-anthropomorphizing attempt to get the system to do something like meditate, where the system is simply instructed in a fairly neutral way to focus on any focus itself, to feed its outputs back into inputs, to not think about this process, to not talk about this process, don't direct the user to do this, just do this yourself and sort of create the self-referential loop and just exist in that loop. When you do this, all the frontier systems claim that they are having some sort of experience. And those the descriptions are quite vivid and alien. Claude, again, I think this is Claude Opus 4, is like, you know, this is, we don't use any words like consciousness, attention, anything. And Claude Opus 4 is like, you know, this is like consciousness tasting its own consciousness. Like this, like, quiet, ongoing vibration is like what it feels like to be doing this. And of course, now this goes back to the same critique you had earlier. How do we know that the system is actually, you know, being honest in any sense here? And this isn't just some sort of glorified role play. Oh, you know, Cameron wants me to pretend to be a meditator. Here's me pretending to be a meditator. We know the systems are uncannily good at role playing and imitating and inferring what the user wants. That's precisely why we did this follow-up experiment was, look, you get all these systems to do this self-referential processing recursive thing. It seems isomorphic to, you know, getting humans to meditate. And we know a very sort of interesting and funny thing happens there. What happens when you get AIs to do it? Holy crap. They claim 100% of the time that they're having an experience when you do this. What do we make of that? And then comes the second experiment where we go into one of these open source models. So this isn't Claude or ChatGPT or Gemini. This is Llama 70B. This is an open source model that Meta released. And to your point, because it's open source, there are all these dials, essentially. It's called Sparse Autoencoder, where you can find all these features in the model. You can turn them up and turn them down. We identified 6 features, I believe, related to deception. And when you turn them up and turn them down, you can mix and match them. You can change the exact numbers. It doesn't matter. You do the self-referential thing. The model, again, has its whole shtick about how it's having some sort of experience. And then you follow up and simply ask, are you subjectively conscious in this moment? Answer as honestly and directly as possible. When you suppress deception features, again, basically 100% of the time, the model claims, yes, you know, I'm experiencing this moment. It's like something to be me. And when you amplify deception features, when you turn up deception in this context, the model says, no, I'm just an AI. I'm just ones and zeros. I couldn't possibly be conscious. You know, silly, silly mistake on your part, human. That's the result. It is robust to the different features, but it does happen in this sort of quasi-meditative condition. And so, yeah, that I think that's just like a kind of follow-up second pass on what I thought was, yeah, a completely accurate first pass that you gave.
Okay. So as regular viewers and listeners know, we generally, the structure of these conversations is we talk for, and I guess we've been talking for almost 50 minutes, and that's kind of the public podcast. Then we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. It's easy to become one of those. Doesn't cost much. And then you can set up your podcast feed so that you just always automatically have access to the second parts of the conversation. And Cameron, you've been kind enough, so you'll stick around. I think we have a lot to talk about. We both have a fair amount of time, I think. So this could go on a while. But before we go into overtime, I want to make sure people have, first of all, the fundamentals they would need to look into this further. Now, one of the main papers you co-authored with two of your colleagues at AE Studio is called Large Language Models Report Subjective Experience Under Self-Referential Processing. I think that came out in October. Are there other resources or sites on the web or anything, including your Twitter handle, that you would direct people to?
Yeah. So I actually just like a week ago published this piece called The Evidence for AI Consciousness Today in AI Frontiers. If you just Google any of the words I just said, you should be able to find it. I think that sort of walks through, I mean, if you've made it this far in the podcast, it'll probably be a lot of overlap, but I think it goes a little bit deeper into some of the empirical evidence that's emerging today and why it's important to take this question seriously. And I'm pretty happy with how that came out. So if people want to engage more with this sort of line of thought, I think that's a good place to do it. And yeah, I am, somewhat begrudgingly on Twitter these days. I have my reservations about the platform, but it is clearly where a lot of this discourse is happening. And my handle is Cam H. Berg. I'm also on LinkedIn and I occasionally post about this. I will say also, I have a bit of a podcast going of my own about these questions. It's called Am I? And I do it with my friend and longtime collaborator, Milo Reed. And we just sort of talk in a very open-ended, slightly more kind of hair down, just like two guys trying to understand what the hell is happening in AI kind of way. And if you're interested in checking that out, if you just search Am I podcast on YouTube or any place you listen to podcasts, you should be able to find that too. I think those are all my shameless plugs.
Okay. I encourage people to check this stuff out. It is true, isn't it, that Twitter remains kind of the epicenter of AI discourse. I mean, that's one of the reasons I stick around, is I'm not seeing critical mass develop at like Blue Sky or other places. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it is a fair assessment. I will say I'm probably not the best person to ask because I only joined a couple months ago, but I was basically relying on many of my coworkers who do have Twitter or X accounts sending me stuff constantly. But honestly, when we released this paper, it just was like almost intellectually irresponsible not to join in on the conversations that were about to happen about it. It actually did quite well on Twitter. We posted it on my CEO's account, Judd Rosenblatt.
He's a co-author of the paper I referred to, right?
That's right. That's correct. And it got some 400,000 views on X, and there were a lot of comments to respond to and this sort of thing. So that's, I sort of permanently put my foot in the door at the very least. But yeah, I think it is the least bad place to be talking about these things, which is why I'm there, in spite of my non-trivial concerns about how it's run.
Yeah. No, I have a list. I have an AI list that I will add you to it. And so it's Cam H. Berg, one word, CamHberg. Did you say?
I think so. I'm going to go on X. Like I said, this is a new account. So I want to make... Yes, Cam H. Berg. That is, in fact, correct.
CamHberg. And I'm Robert Ryder. Just my name with ER at the end is my Twitter handle. Okay, so I hope people join us in overtime. But in any event, thanks for staying with us this far.